This is Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. You can find out more at allbook-books.com. This week, an interview with Aria F. Jenkins and her recent book of poetry, Singing in the Dark, published by Alien Buddha Press. Aria is a Colombian-American poet and writer whose poems have appeared in many journals and zines. Most recently, Hawaii Pacific Review, Jerry Jazz Musician, and Oye Drum Magazine. Her poetry has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize and has been widely anthologized. She has also published poetry reviews in Cleaver Magazine, Cedar Press Review, Rhino Poetry, The Poetry Cafe, and Volume 1, Brooklyn. In 2021, her poem Ruin was selected as a finalist for the Derek Burleson Poetry Prize by... I don't know how to pronounce that press. I'll spell it because it's so different. C-H-O-E-O-F-P-L-E-I-R-N Press. She's the author of three poetry chapbooks, including one published by All Book Books, Jewel Fire, a short story collection, Blue Songs in an Open Key, Fomite Press 2018, and a novel, Punk Disco Bohemian, Nine Star Press 2021. So thanks for listening.
Yeah, hi, Aria F. Jenkins. Welcome to the little podcast, Get Lit with Literature. Thanks for making the time. It's been a while since we talked. I published your book, a little chapbook, in 2011 called Jewel Fire, which when you let me know by email or snail mail, you're still out there selling that book, which is impressive. And recently you sent me your small chapbook, but very potent, published by Alien Buddha Press, which has a cool, very cool cover. I don't even sure I could describe it. It's kind of like a neon Buddha, sort of like a space scene. And the title is Singing in the Dark, which I like that title a lot. It's, I don't know, it just makes me think of like that's sort of like what's going on in the world nowadays. It's like we have to keep singing because it seems kind of dark sometimes. But anyway, yeah, I enjoyed reading the poems, and we'll talk about that. So, yeah, that's sort of a long welcome, and anything you want to add to that to start off?
No, thanks, Monk. It's good to talk with you again, and you did publish my first poetry chapbook and got me started again on writing, which I'm still doing. And Singing in the Dark is my fourth chapbook, my fourth poetry chapbook. And it's a combination of confessional poems and poems about causes that are important to me out in the world. In defense of the confessional poetry, which only one guy that I know has commented on, you know, confessional poetry was something that was popular in the 60s and 70s with Lowell and Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath and W.D. Snodgrass. And they were sort of the big guys in that arena. But the wonderful thing about it for me as a female Buddhist writing is that they reflect on interiority, which was something that is new. And they go to those dark inner spaces. And they explore it. And psychologically speaking, it's super important for the poet to know who he or she is in order to speak about the world. Just like in relationship, you can't really know or love someone else until you know and accept who you are with all the darkness and the grief and everything else that's involved. And it seems in some ways that women, to my mind, have an easier time going to those places than men do. Mm-hmm. So I may be wrong on that, but it does seem like that is the case. They are less afraid to dive deep, to go there. And some of my favorite poets are very good at that. So anyway, that's the bonus for starting out on the confessional realm, right? And then moving into talking about causes in the second half of the book, there is you know, reaching outward that is a natural extension of that. So that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, it's interesting, the labels, which can be tricky, or, you know, I don't tend to not like the labels that try to label things, but, like, I had written down one of my first impressions. The confessional word did not come to mind. I wrote down poignant portrayals. That was a word I put down.
Yeah, no, thank you. I appreciate that. But that, you know, the labels help to identify something in history.
Yeah,
so that's why we go there.
To me, I wouldn't want to label yours confessional because you're writing about personals. Some personal stuff, but it's like, I don't know. I think of confessional poetry as like sort of just. It's not my favorite, honestly. Like it gets like overly done. To me, you know, some people like it, but yours, it didn't come across that way. So I like those. And then it jumps into what I would sort of label, like I wrote down powerful socio-political, and in which you
that
also,
works.
The personal, like you intertwine your personal experience into the poem, which I like a lot. So it's not just, I mean, rants are fine, but it's like, it's not just a rant or something on a particular topic. You kind of, you know, it's a way that, you could be talking about the most, you know, political, philosophical, whatever it is, but like I always say, the thing that history books used to bore me a lot, and I think if there's a hook, like, you know, if they said Alexander the Great woke up and made scrambled eggs and hot coffee, and then he went out into the Macedonian sun and, you know, conquered that to me, there's a hook because I can relate to the person. Not just, you know, in whatever, 4000 BC, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think your poems kind of, they blend in that way. So I like that about it. One of the ones that I like, and I think a lot of poetry is like, if it evokes, you as a writer don't know what it's going to evoke in other people. So you have one, I think it's in My Father's Country, where you say, but those first days... Yeah, those first days in my father's country, rain fell just for me. And, that's beautiful. And it reminded me of, I remember driving home from Passover dinners when I was little. I don't even remember how old, like maybe 5, 10, I don't remember. But I remember, do you ever like, you know, you're driving and you see the moon, and no matter where you go, it's like the moon always seems like, it's like it's following.
And right.
That was like one of my... I don't know. I just have that memory. It's like the moon is following just for me. So yeah. I can relate to that, you know, that poem a lot. And that's also talks about some of your upbringing. So, you know, say a little about that with your father.
Right. I mean, I like to combine, interweave history with personal experience because it helps to ground it in some kind of commonality, I think. And sometimes, you know, maybe those of us that come from bicultural background or, you know, just, I was really a stranger in a strange land when I got here in the 60s. We all felt like that. Mm-hmm. And so that the experience never really goes away, of not really knowing where you belong. And it sort of feeds your work, or it has fed my work, and both as a writer and a poet. And,
But you grew up in Colombia, right?
No, I grew up in Peru.
Okay.
I was born in Colombia, and I grew up in Peru and spent some time in Mexico before we got to the States.
Wow.
And, so now this is my country, obviously. And I speak as a poet mostly in English, but there have been poems I've written that have come from that other language space. And I wrote one for an anthology that I edited a while back on war. And I actually wrote it initially in Spanish and then translated it into English. And actually my Spanish, which is my maternal tongue, is pretty strong. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I don't reach out to that more. But in any case, maybe because English is more familiar.
Did you have any, because I'm always interested in, like, the original peoples, the indigenous peoples, you know, from wherever, did you have any experience or interaction growing up, you know, from Peru, Mexico, and Colombia? Those are
no,
powerful.
No, not at all. No, my understanding of the indigenous came from my paternal grandmother, who had an indigenous roots and kept a newspaper or subscribed to a newspaper on the rights of Indians and so forth, and she would share things with me from time to time. I am interested, of course, in poets who are indigenous and in, you know, diverse poets. Mm-hmm. Mexican poet Raul Sanchez is a writes nature poems that actually remind me a lot of Aurelio Arturo, who was in my mind a Colombian Walt Whitman, wrote beautifully about nature in the early 1900s. And I read recently that Rena Priest, who's Washington's first indigenous state poet laureate, mm-hmm. I think from the Lummi Nation, she writes, "You can have a sweet voice too," which is really interesting about poetry, because I've been reflecting recently that poetry is often really loud these days, you know?
Yeah, a lot of the spoken
especially
word.
Especially with the emphasis of spoken word,
yeah,
the microphone and everything like that. But that, not all poetry that is really good has to be loud, you
mm-hmm.
know? It can cause us to reflect, and it can be sweet, and it can be subtle, even if it is powerful and inspires us to reflect. So, I was moved by that perception coming from an indigenous poet, and I agree.
Yeah, I have to throw in my personal opinion about Walt Whitman, because I used to be like a devotee, but that changed radically
mm-hmm.
When I read in, I think it was, what's her name, Dunbar Ortiz, her last name. She has a book, Indigenous People's History of the U.S., and she quotes some very like racist things that Whitman said. And aside from that, I mean, some of his stuff, you know, I think the poetry, he has a lot of wonderful poetry, but one of his things was he wrote a lot about the, quote, New World. So I think he was overlooking the peoples that were already here a lot. So I
mm-hmm.
that's changed my opinion about Whitman, but that's that's a side topic. I just had to throw that in.
Right, right. I'm referring to him as a nature poet.
Right,
here.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he certainly, his exuberance and his...
Exactly.
There's one I used to love, trying to remember the name. Just like he's out walking and he notices everything. And oh, yeah, you know, that's the part of Whitman I still appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
But also something we have similar ways in writing on is you cover a lot of different territory, you know, and different peoples. You have interests, like you have a poem about Palestine, and you have a poem about Tibetans. And so that's something I tend to do a lot too, is jump around from place to place. The one for Palestine, Protest for Palestine, that's got some powerful lines, like you have and you pretending the caterwauling of horror is but the sea calling, with the cry of sirens and bombs we have told ourselves is but the sea calling. And that's like really powerful. It's one of those topics that stirs a lot of argument, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm always, you know, my mom had this in her as well. And my dad even too. The love, or the special love for the oppressed, the small and forgotten nations and the indigenous and the poor people and all that. I grew up with an appreciation of that.
Mm, okay.
Because they were right outside our house, you know, and some of them worked for us. So our lives were intertwined, and our stories intertwined. And I think the important thing always to remember is how our stories intertwine, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what poetry calls me to do anyway.
Yeah, that's a neat one. That's a neat, I like the word intertwine evokes a lot. And then the other strong one, like in the Forgotten Country about Tibet, you have... pepper spraying, contorting figures swathed in blue, white, red, green, and yellow flags as if trying to extinguish them. So that's like, I mean, that's like a intense haiku there. Like you're talking about the struggles, and yeah, there's not much to say about that, because that's powerful, and it reminds, that's obviously, that I think that's referring to the Tibetan flags, right?
Well, that was
the colors.
That's actually, I took a photo that was published in some newspaper in New York after attending a demonstration where New York's finest was really at its worst, really mistreating the small group of Tibetans that were in front of the Chinese embassy, and that was really why.
Okay.
They were being downtrodden, literally. And so anyway, that I captured a really strong photo, and that's what I was thinking of and seeing when I wrote that poem.
Well, yeah, that's you're sort of, again, that's somewhat similar with me, as sort of like activist poet is kind of one label I might try to use. Mm-hmm. You know, time. Sometimes I'm just, it'll be a beautiful poem about whatever's going on. See a flower or a bird that day, but then other times it's like, oh, this just becomes a vehicle for, I got to say something about this topic.
Right.
Let's see, I want to quote another one, and then I'll have you read one, because it's always best to hear it in the poet's voice. But another really powerful, your poem, Sitting Still. When I grew up, I learned sitting still can create a fire at your core that fuels everything. So I started meditating as an act of resistance. So yeah, that's sort of what we were just saying about the meditation, poetry, activism, and it's all right there. How old were you when you got into that zone, so to speak?
What, meditating?
Yeah, when I grew up, I learned sitting still can create a fire. Yeah.
I think I started meditating in my early 30s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's a powerful line. So the one I'd like you to read is, I don't even know if I can pronounce it, Le Infidèle?
L'Infidèle.
Okay. And that's, is that French?
Yes, it is.
Like infidel, right?
It means not loyal or, okay, you know, betraying something.
Yeah. Let's hear your poem.
Okay, it's called L'Infidèle. O faithless one, if you were to have faith, what would you have faith in? Be content. The bowl of soup, neither spicy nor salty, is enough. The hush of dusk, enough. The refrains of night, more than enough. The whirring of a fan overhead, like the hand of God conjuring magic, enough. Roaming cars and people, the spectacle of noise and of solitude, all equal. None should cause dismay, for I am part of the chatter and silence both, a cog in the endless wheel that is the only thing I know will keep turning.
Oh, that's wonderful. That seems to have some of the Buddhist flavoring there.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, I also like it, you know, with, even without that label, I like it because it's a reminder of, like, nowadays, the sort of catchphrases are, you know, gratitude and thankfulness and all that, but it's that, you know, you give, it's just a reminder of the being content with just seeing what's going on, and that can be enough rather than all the greed and all that going on.
Well, thanks, Monk, for letting me reflect a little bit on poetry and read my poems.
Oh, yeah.
Read my poem. I really appreciate it, and definitely your publishing poetry is also great that you're still doing that.
Yeah, thanks, Arya. It's poetry is it's ongoing and it's ever changing, and so I appreciate, and then, you know, especially in the busy world, oftentimes poetry is much more accessible. Another one you have, I think you have, you're also very influenced by jazz music, because I started reading, I forget the title of your short story book, Something Blue.
Blue Songs in an Open Key.
Blue Songs in an Open Key, yeah. So those are, like, I think there's music in each one of them.
Right.
And then maybe you want to read your poem, When, A Melody for Jazz?
I'd actually prefer to read, if you don't mind.
Okay.
A poem I published recently in Jerry Jazz Musician. They've been asking me to write poems for them.
Okay.
It's a website that's devoted to jazz, and I read this recently, and I like it. It's about, it was actually written after seeing the documentary on Nina Simone that was on Netflix. It's a narrative poem, and some of the quotes and stories, it's from some of the stories in What Happened, Miss Nina Simone.
Okay.
Or Miss Simone, excuse me. What Happened, Miss Simone. It's called Nina, as in Nina Simone. As a child, Eunice crossed railroad tracks to learn classical piano, music being her language, her access to other worlds. She became Nina Simone, the performer, aspiring to become a rich black bitch. Success came, but with it, depression, exhaustion, and rage. She was pushed hard and beaten by her manager husband. But pain only serves the artist to remind her of what is out there, that Nina was part of too. The murders of four little black girls in Birmingham in 63 inspired her to become the first black, first female, first artist to declare in song, Mississippi, goddamn. She joined the civil rights movement, hoping to drive white people insane with her music. A matter of survival, she said. How can you be an artist and not reflect the times? Staring down audiences like a madwoman, Nina demanded they bear witness to long-denied horrors. They're shooting us down one by one. Don't forget that, because they are. No matter the highs or lows, music always flowed. Nina channeled the blues, sometimes lulling, sometimes pummeling people, calling them out in order to write history.
Wow, that's potent. Yeah, it's a good biopic and cover a lot there.
I wanted to read that because of the activist discussion and poetry and artistry in general, which you can have and be, obviously. There's this still, you know, longstanding myth that I'm sure you know, that a person can only be one thing, especially a woman. And you can be many things. Even the poets who are known as mainly poets are many things, mm-hmm. you know. Jane Hirschfield is a translator, an essayist, and a poet.
Mm-hmm.
Nina Simone was a singer, artist, performer, brilliant performer, classical pianist, etc. So, yeah, activism has to be at the root, in the case of the modern artist and poet. In many ways, it has to be in there.
Yeah, that's a sort of like throwing down the gauntlet to, like, you know, I think it's a good challenge to people, like, hey, you know, do some more of that poetry, because I think it is, I agree, it is needed, and it is, you know, poetry, it doesn't have to just go in poetry journals. Sometimes I feel the best about, hey, I got a poem at a website, like there's a, you know, different website that is a news website or an activist web somewhere, and different people are seeing it than just inside the poetry box, so... I think that's good for people to try, and also I think listen to music, jazz. I think
absolutely.
I can't measure it, but subtly, I think listening to jazz and all kinds of music. I don't listen to a lot of jazz, but over the years, I think it's really helped for just the rhythm and the way the poem flows.
Mm-hmm.
I got want to read, because that one of my favorite bits in your poem in the Singing in the Dark, when a melody for jazz. Or when, standing alone where you are, on the beach of your life, you acknowledge finally what matters most, despite all the swirling incongruities, the music that is your music, that is the one thing you can count on. I love that, because you could put something else in place of music, but it is also just like what music kind of represents in the big picture, you know, when you're sometimes I'm just out there humming to myself, and like that's like one of those things I can count on. So
right.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way. Another way you take like the wide angle of the beach, and then you bring it into the personal.
Interesting that you pick up on the visual, because a lot of my poems and my writing in general is very visual. I'm a photographer too, so some of the stuff that I do is really inspired by really what I've seen or captured on with the camera.
Yeah, I always encourage writers are like the five senses, just to really try to put not just sight, because sight's kind of the easiest one to do. I think a lot of writing is a lot sight, but to throw in some sounds and smells and as much as you can, taste and touch. Sometimes they're harder, but it's more like regular, actual lifelike, because that's what we're doing all the time. So if you put that in the writing, it helps. Where can people get your book from?
I think the best place for people to get most of my books can be found on Amazon.
Okay.
You mentioned Blue Songs in an Open Key, and you can get that from the publisher online as well.
Okay.
But it's easiest to find them all on on Amazon.com. Just Singing in the Dark, and my name, Arya, is spelled A-R-Y-A-F Jenkins.
Excellent.
So that's great. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about poetry or my poetry.
You're welcome.
With
yeah.
you in an interview. That is rare for me. And and it's great to be able to talk about poetry in general.
Yeah, so. I always learn, it's neat to learn, some of your background and how that's flavored, how that flavors your poetry and the photography. And I agree a lot. Sometimes there's somebody I know as a famous poet or a novelist, and then I go look online. And then I was like, I had no idea they wrote or are writing, poems, essays, short story. It's like, wow. Yeah. I think when someone is tuned in or whatever, as a writer or whatever, artist that like, just to be open to the message or whatever you call it coming through, not just stuck in the genre. That's fine too. If you're, if all you do is one, but I think that's another way to allow for the creative process. And yeah, why don't maybe just wrap it up a little bit with anything you want to say about your creative process that might help other people's writings, and any suggestions?
Oh yeah, sure. I think, it's really an individual thing, but for me, learning to meditate has really, really lifted the lid in terms of how I approach it, how I approach writing of whatever sort, because it's really about being with the idea that's coming through, and some of my stuff has really not taken very long to come out, but it's really after sitting still and processing all the junk, right, that you can actually sit down and know what needs to be said. And then, of course, you're editing and refining in most cases, but poetry especially is something that comes from a deep, for me, has to come from a deep, still place. And that's cultivated through the practice of sitting for me. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of just going over and over and over in drafts and drafts and drafts so much now as it is of just listening to inspiration and being there for it. And I really try not to get caught up in the rat race of writing and publishing, which is really tempting to those of us who are on social media. I have stuff that is out there. I have, I think, 10 things under consideration right now. Some of, in different publications. And, I had sent them out. Some of them have been sent out like 3 months ago. And you can't hold your breath for that sort of thing, just for the other end of the writing process. You just have to keep doing your thing, whatever it is. If you publish 2 or 3 times a year, great. If you publish 50 times a year, great. It's really all in the quality and how you feel about the work. The bottom line is how you feel about the work.
Yeah, and who you reach.
Not so much how you feel about the reception. That's just an instant, it's a bonus that lasts about an instant. It's nice. I'm not denigrating it, but I'm saying, how long does applause last, right? Even on social media.
Yeah, and it's like I mentioned recently, it's back to the silence. which, you know, again, is that stillness. And I think the reaching people, like I recently wrote a poem for my great, about my great nephew. And it was like, you know, wow, I feel as good about that. And, you know, mostly family reading it, then, you know, that's like, I don't know, it's, I can't compare it with getting published and people say, oh, wow, that's, you know, that's cool. But they're both part of the deal. Yeah, just one thing you said about the stillness, I think, is very important, because the other day I was remembering when I first started getting into haiku, and one of the things that was like a breakthrough was there's this line from Basho, who's considered the first haiku master, and it's learn from the pines about the pine and from the bamboo about the bamboo. And it kind of sounds like, what? It sounds sort of so obvious, but I remember I was reading a book by a Japanese guy, I think it's the Japanese Haiku by Kenneth Yasuda, and it made me go outside and sit on the patio and like stare at a flower or a plant or a tree, and it was just, I had this thing like, okay, I just got to be with this for however long. It could be 5 minutes, right. It could be a few hours. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to sit there and be with it and be with that being, not it. It's like, you know, a living being. And and I don't remember exactly, but it was like something clicked. And it was like, oh, now I can sort of genuinely write a poem about that flower, that tree, not just, you know, sort of just, oh, as I'm walking by and I notice something. It was something about the energy of just being with it. And that's, exactly. You know, your stillness, I think.
Yeah, I feel like we're losing a lot of that now, you know, that ability to be with. Mm-hmm. Is so important for artists and writers and poets of all kinds. You have to know how to be with, and we have so many distractions. So I, you know, solitude and stillness and all that are extremely important in order to stay alive in whatever art you're involved in.
All right. Yeah, that seems like a good message to wrap it up on. So, yeah, thanks so much, Aria. And
thank you, Monk.
Keep on doing what you're doing and your multifaceted arts endeavors and activism and all that.
Thank you.
All right.
You too.
Thanks, Aria. Be well.
Bye.